The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Kimberly Atkins-Store, Joyce Vance, Barb McQuaid, and me, Jill Wine Banks. Let's get to the show right away because we have some really good topics. We're going to, of course, be discussing immunity, a five-alarm fire, to quote two of our justices. We are also going to talk about the social media cases and the First Amendment. And we'll talk about some of the consequences that have already happened since the Supreme Court ended the Chevron deference. But before we get to that, we just celebrated the 4th of July, and
Brisby's still celebrating.
He apparently is. He's not afraid, obviously, of fireworks. Anyway, we're now celebrating the 4th of July, and I want to talk to you all about what you did and how you grill. That's important. My husband's looking for new ways and maybe some special recipes if you have any for the holiday.
Well, you know, as far as grilling goes, we have a new local butcher store. So we got really great Wagyu burgers. Usually we're a little bit more upscale and prone to do ribs, but this year we did burgers. They were great. But I'll tell you what the best 4th of July recipe in our house is. It is an angel food cake made with strawberry whipped cream. It's my mom's recipe. Her mom made it before her, and it's just not 4th of July without it.
Mmm. I'm coming to your house.
Good stuff.
Sounds good. And also, it's sort of similar to my favorite recipe, which comes from a law school classmate of mine when we were still in law school. So I've had that recipe probably longer than you've had yours from your mom. And it's for a trifle. And the trifle I have moderated because I don't like making my own fresh whipped cream. I use frozen strawberries. I use store-bought angel food cake. But for 4th of July, I use, instead of just strawberries, on the top I put a flag made out of blueberries and strawberries plus the whipped cream. So it's really a fun recipe. Everybody loves it, and it serves a crowd.
This is now the Sister-in-Law's Baked Cakes podcast. New season.
Well, Well, so, Kim, what about you?
I don't bake on the 4th of July. Yeah. But one thing that I think people sleep on when it comes to grilling are vegetables. Actually, vegetables are my very favorite thing to grill. And they're so easy to do. Even if you don't have, you know, the special like little containers that you can put the vegetables in so that they don't fall out, all you have to do is a little bit of foil. Yeah. And I put everything on there, from potatoes and onions and green peppers and all kinds of stuff. But my favorite thing is zucchini. I saw somebody post some sort of nonsense on socials about nobody really likes zucchini and it's just food that it's like filler food. Incorrect. Zucchini, especially grilled with like a nice balsamic on it, a little bit of olive oil, that is divine summer food right there.
In defense of the zucchini.
Delicious.
Interesting. And well, we grilled burgers and dogs and chicken. We had a house full yesterday, which was really fun. Some of our kids were home, and mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister, brother-in-law, all kinds of people. It was really fun. But, you know, I'm not a big baker. We had berries and watermelon that I thought would be healthy dessert options, but everyone else opted for ice cream, which I did as well, because that is my Achilles heel is ice cream. I also, though, got a great dessert. I ran in the Ann Arbor Firecracker 5K, and not only does every finisher get a medal, every finisher gets a bomb pop. So that was probably the highlight of my eating day.
Sounds
bomb
good.
Bomb pop at 9 a.m. It's not too early to get a bomb pop, is it?
You have to tell me what a bomb pop is.
Oh, come on. Where were you during the bicentennial? It's a popsicle that's red, white, and blue, and it's shaped like a little rocket.
Okay, I do know that. I do know that. My husband actually burned his eyebrows off with our gas grill, so he has converted it into a charcoal grill, and he has now started marinating the steak in a salad dressing and some seasoning before he cooks it. And it's really good that way. He's really come a long way in terms of his grilling.
Well, I'm glad he's okay now, but I have to say the taste of charcoal grills is much better than the taste of gas grills. Like I said it.
And we have a gas grill too. I agree on that about charcoal, but not on zucchini. Sorry.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Well, by now everyone knows that the Supreme Court decided the immunity appeal brought by Donald Trump on Monday. The decision was far worse than I thought possible. But this is my first chance to talk about it with Jill and Barb and Kim, and I'm really eager to hear what they think about it. So let's start there. We've had the week to read the opinion and assess it. What do each of you think about the court's decision? Kim?
Yeah, you know, on the one hand, it was exactly what I had been predicting it would be, which is some immunity, not total, but effectively ensuring that there would be no trial. And that's exactly what happened. But the devil is in the details, right? And the details were so much worse than I thought that they would be, not just in the ruling, just kind of painting out these broad brushes of categories of immunity, but also in the way that the Chief Justice the job of the Supreme Court in whatever case it's deciding is to decide the case before it, right? And the way that he sort of took a cue from Neil Gorsuch, who at the argument said, oh, we're writing a decision for the ages, and pretended like he was not writing the immunity rules for Donald Trump, but just writing some, like, you know, general immunity rules for all other presidents for the rest of time. No, the case before you has to do with Donald Trump. And he seemed to avoid, basically, maybe he just didn't want to say, hey, I'm going to give Donald Trump, this person who has proven to be extremely dangerous, this really broad immunity and make it really hard for him to be held accountable for his danger by saying, oh, it's for the ages. You know, we have a constitution, and we need all these broad protections. So I think I don't even comprehend how bad it is just yet, but it's bad.
Yeah. Jill, what do you think?
I agree with you and Kim. I think it was way, way worse than I ever expected it to be. It didn't officially grant total immunity, but effectively it did. The way they described that middle category and the way they don't describe the final category of personal, to me, leaves it open to the subjective judgment of any future court at the lower level, at the intermediate appellate level, and again, at the Supreme Court level. And so I really am concerned about what this means for any future president who wants to abuse his powers. We've seen it with Richard Nixon. We've seen it with Donald Trump, and it is frightening beyond belief to think that a president can commit a crime that anyone else would be charged with. And no, it's okay because he can claim that it is an official act, even though to the average human being and to Brisby, it's clear that it is definitely not anyway near a presidentially authorized act. And you can't even look at the evidence of it, and you can't look at the motive. Those are terribly damaging to our democracy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a hall pass for criming if you're Donald Trump. And, you know, it's alarming to me that the Supreme Court really left it so amorphous. I mean, you can't pin down, as you say, Jill, that second category where you're distinguishing official acts from unofficial acts. It's pretty much whatever the Supreme Court says when this case comes back up on appeal to them. And I'm a little bit, I mean, I hope I'm not being a cynic here. Maybe Kim, I'm too far out on our ledge right now. But it seems to me that they gave this broad read right now that's very beneficial to Donald Trump, but they won't really have to own it until after they know the outcome of the election, right? Judge Chutkan will make her decisions. It will go back on appeal. They won't have to say for sure if Donald Trump gets immunity or not until after they know if he wins. And just, I don't know, Barb, do you think, have I gone too far with that?
No. And, you know, I think what's so disheartening, it doesn't surprise me that there's some part of the president's powers that are immune from criminal prosecution. You know, one of the things that, and they divided into those three categories. And one, they talk about core constitutional functions. So when the president is acting in his capacity as commander in chief of the armed services, you know, and orders a drone strike, you know, that's the kind of thing. Maybe there's room for some immunity there. But it's the abuse of powers that concerns me. You know, even a police officer who uses his badge under color of law and abuses it by, you know, violating someone's civil rights, right? Deliberately attacking them, beating them in jail or something like that. They don't get any protection. It's a really high standard, though. You have to show that it was a willful violation of a known legal right. So I really was expecting something there, because this absolute immunity means, like, we've been thinking about the Constitution all wrong for well over 200 years. I mean, Jill, I'd like to ask you about, like, you charged the president, right?
In
Watergate. We all assumed that the president could be charged, right? Now, I mean, Ford thought he needed to pardon Nixon, right? Nixon thought he needed to resign. So was everybody just so wrong in all this time? And Roberts has been waiting all his life to tell us what it really says? I mean, Jill, back in the 70s, were you thinking that there was any immunity at all for a president?
Never occurred to us. Well, clearly there was a privilege in terms of executive privilege, but that there was immunity for crimes was never, ever, not especially for a former president. And there was a question of whether you could indict while someone was sitting in office, but not once they got out of office for anything they did in office, before office, or after office. And Richard Nixon, I'm sure, is celebrating wherever he is now, because had this been the law, or had this been the Supreme Court when he was in office, he would have served his full term. He wouldn't have needed a pardon. Gerald Ford probably would have been reelected or elected for the first time since he was only serving when he substituted for Nixon. When he resigned, he became president from being vice president. But he would have been reelected. He wasn't, in part because he granted the pardon to someone who was a recognized criminal. And this is just devastating. And especially, you know, Joyce, you mentioned that middle category. And the court puts into that middle category when he talks to his people at the Department of Justice, even if it is to plot a conspiracy to overturn the election. You can't look at the reason for the conversation, because they say having conversations with your cabinet officers is, that's a presidential responsibility. Right. No, it's not if it's to commit a crime. So it is terrifying, and Nixon would have been thrilled. I wrote a piece for MSNBC about the immunity decision and the impact it is going to have going forward and what it would have meant to Richard Nixon.
Yeah, Richard Nixon would have never resigned, right? I mean, no. God, if he had known this was the law, man, stay in office.
Although he at least had some sense of shame, something that doesn't seem to exist now. And he did take the advice that he would be convicted by the Senate after impeachment by the House. And he resigned in shame and, you know, tucked his tail between his legs and flew home to San Clemente.
But he also told Frost afterwards, if the president does it, it's not a crime. So he was right.
He was.
Yeah, we were all appalled, right, at the time.
Oh, yuck, don't say that. That's so horrible. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, Donald Trump came out and said, well, I was completely exonerated by this decision, which is not true, by the way. All the decision says is you can commit crimes, you just can't be prosecuted. It's no exoneration. Kim, something that we talk about, and I know our listeners have questions about, are concurring opinions. And we had concurrences here. So the first one I want to talk about is Justice Thomas's concurring opinion.
Ooh, boy.
I don't know why the hell he was participating in this case. He had a clear conflict and should have recused. But leaving that aside, were you surprised by the issue that he decided to focus on in his concurrence?
Well, no, I wasn't actually once I read it. And maybe that gives a clue why he was so eager to participate in this, because what he focused on was an issue that wasn't even raised in this case, which was the propriety of the appointment of Jack Smith as special counsel. Now, we have said on this podcast, not once, not twice, but many, many times, that the constitutionality of a special counsel is an issue that has been litigated, it has been decided, it has been asked and answered. There is no outstanding legal or constitutional issue here. But Clarence Thomas seems to insist that there is, that unless he, the special counsel himself is goes before the Senate and is confirmed, that he cannot do this job. Of course, we've had many of them going back to Watergate. But I think I know why he's doing this, right? Because one of the other cases that Donald Trump is facing down in Florida, someone raised an issue, that someone would be Donald Trump, about the constitutionality of Jack Smith's appointment. And that's one of the many motions that Judge Aileen Cannon has yet to rule on. So what I think is going on here is Clarence Thomas is like, hey, Aileen, we are happy to take up this issue if you want to rule against Jack Smith and kick this thing either way down the road or kick it off your docket completely. We are here for it. Give us a holla. So I think that's why he sat. And I think that's why he also sat because he doesn't believe the rules apply to him. But I think that's what this concurrence is all about. And it's a hot mess.
Okay, so we've got Justice Thomas's love letter to Aileen Cannon. We've also got another concurrence, maybe a slightly less inside baseball one from Justice Barrett. And Jill, she did not join Section 3C of the opinion. What is that about? And can you talk about what happens when justices join part but not all of a majority opinion?
Sure. And of course, this one is still a majority opinion, even without her on this. She is showing some independence. That's, I think, true. And I just want to, before I go on to your question, just say, you know, we've had this discussion about whether the Supreme Court has gotten too political. And you all have said to me that absolutely not. The order of opinions isn't political. Don't tell me that this isn't political. Kim, you've just made my argument that they did this.
Well, I don't say they never act politically. I just said they're such a hot mess, and it was probably the dissents that made that case take so long, and I think that was right.
Exactly. So anyway, Justice Barrett has shown her some independence from the other members of the conservative caucus, and she said they went too far in terms of saying about the evidence. And that is, of course, as I said, the thing that bothers me the most is them predetermining what Rule 403 is intended to do, is to let, in context, a decision be made about whether something is overly prejudicial and can't be introduced. So I think they went too far, and that's what she said. What it means is that she gets to express her opinion and deviate from what the full court majority said, and hers has some bearing on the future, can be cited. Sometimes dissents are more cited even than the majority opinion.
So, you know, those are the concurrences. Barb, there is also a series of dissents, two dissents in this case, that are very powerful. What was your takeaway from the dissents, either or both of them?
Yeah, I thought that the most powerful thing in all of these dissents, well, actually, I thought there are two very powerful things. One is, I'll start with this, Justice Sotomayor writes this dissent and really, to me, points out the hypocrisy of the majority when it cites Dobbs, right? The case that overturns Roe versus Wade, and points out how the, you know, just it, as recently as last term majority, what you said was, there must be a firm grounding in constitutional text, history, or precedent to recognize some sort of right or doctrine. And she says, there is no official acts immunity in the Constitution. It's not written in there. And so they accused, you know, the Roe Court of just making this up by looking at lots of different provisions in the Constitution and then, you know, using logic to conclude that that right exists there. Well, that's what the court is doing in this case. And so right at the get-go, she cites Dobbs, which I think is quite devastating for the hypocrisy. But I think she really focuses on why this opinion is so problematic. When, remember all those hypotheticals during oral argument that everybody said, well, that's ridiculous. Why are they even talking about that? You know, SEAL Team 6. The only reason that issue was ever raised in the first place, of course, was because the thought that, of course, these things can't be permissible. But she points out, going forward, if a president orders Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, immune. Organize a military coup to hold on to power, immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon, immune. Immune, immune, immune. And that's a direct quote. She says that. And then, you know, the majority responds to this and they say, oh, the dissenters use extreme hypotheticals to say there is no such thing, but they never refute them. They never say those hypotheticals aren't true. They get into this whole idea of like, it's got to be in the text and it doesn't have to be in the text. It's we can presume this from, you know, privileges and other kinds of things. So they do not refute them because they're true. Now, a president still could be impeached if he did any of those bad things, like ordering SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his rivals or accept a bribe or whatever it is. But imagine a president who does this on the last days of office. There's not going to be time to impeach him. And so if he orders a military coup on January 18th or assassinates his rivals or accepts bribes, go ahead and impeach me. And, you know, also, I think realistically, is impeachment really a meaningful check anymore when our politics have become so polarized? And I think Chief Justice Roberts just kind of ignores the reality when he says that. So that to me is why this opinion is really awful. And I hope someday will be overturned.
Well, it's just shocking to think that Chief Justice Roberts would ever ignore reality, sort of like he did in Shelby County versus Holder, the voting rights case. But Barb, I want to even push further on your hypo, because it seems to me now that presidents can assassinate their political rivals at will, you don't even have to wait until the end of the term. You just go ahead and do it right up front, because who in the Senate is coming after you on impeachment, knowing that you can just assassinate them too, right? It's a lawless paradigm with the president as the most lawless guy in the room. And it's really scary. Jill, how did you react in that sense?
So, well, there's a couple things I want to say about the dissent. One was its condescending nature. I mean, at the dissent, the majority opinion, sorry, toward the dissenters. I mean, the language was terrible. They used language like hysterical. And I found it to be extremely sexist. And I think Dahlia Lithwick wrote a very good piece that we can put on our show notes to let people read a very detailed exposition of that. But also Barbara mentioned, you know, bribery. Well, remember what the court did on bribery? It's just a gratuity. It's not a bribe. So what bribes are going to survive? I mean, Donald Trump has already said, give me $1 billion and I'll make sure all your problems go away to the oil executives. Well, if they pay him, is that a bribe or is that a gratuity because he's going to do a good thing for them or has done a good thing? I think it's really, really terrible. I thought the dissents made a lot of sense. The extreme hypotheticals were things that were posed in Supreme Court arguments. And I believe the court has gone beyond what even Donald Trump's lawyers asked for in that. They went beyond what could have ever been expected to be considered as partly within the constitutional responsibilities of the president. And so I agree with Barb's analysis completely, and it's terrible. The dissents were brilliant and accurate.
Hey, Kim, I'd love to hear you chime in on the dissents, but I also wanted to ask what your sense of what Jack Smith does next is. I mean, does he even have a case left to prosecute after this?
I mean, he does. I associate myself with the comments of my sisters with respect to the dissents. But yeah, so the cases, as I read it, I've read and reread the Chief Justice's ruling. I think certainly with respect to the phony elector scheme and perhaps his actions on January 6th itself with that rally and sicking people on there, although I can see, you know, there seemed to be some indication that that might be considered, you know, a president needs broad authority to speak to the public. And I'm like, that was a campaign rally at best. But anyway, after Judge Chutkan goes through and makes a clear record of that and rules, I think those might be okay. The one that I think is just crazy, though, and that probably doesn't make it, is the claims with respect to his pressuring Mike Pence to try to not count the electoral votes. I mean, it sounds like, okay, no, there's that is not necessarily official conduct, but it's a real strong presumption that that's official conduct. And if that's official conduct, like pressuring your own vice president to do crimes, then that's a roadmap to the next despot who wants to get to the White House and use all the levers to say, hey, DOJ, what we already know for sure, without question, that Trump's weaponization of the DOJ, totally immune. And he can also pressure people within his own White House to do crimes. That's crazy. And it sounds like that's what this opinion says. So if I were Jack Smith, I'd probably at least proceed, maybe just proceed, unfortunately, on those with respect to those, the electors and the actions on January 6th. But my goodness, this is crazy that this is where we are.
So Barb, what would you do if you were Jack Smith? Do you agree with Kim? Do you think he's got a narrow path forward?
He does, but you know, it's an okay path. I think that he probably should just dump the DOJ allegations, which really gnaws at me, because that to me was the most offensive. You know, Jeffrey Clark writing those letters falsely claiming that the Justice Department had found irregularities in the election and urging state legislatures to reconvene to select new slates of electors. I mean, that's just appalling that you would use the Justice Department for that. But I think it's clear under this opinion that that's going to be immune. I think even the Mike Pence stuff, you know, there's room. It's an uphill battle to litigate it, but maybe you just dump it. because what it leaves is there's still some okay stuff left, right? I mean, organizing false slates of electors and pressuring state officials to flip the outcome of the election, like Brad Raffensperger. And then also there's the theory that they exploited the chaos at the Capitol to continue to pressure legislators to refuse to certify the election. So I think those go forward. That's like 60% of the case, right? There were five schemes. It sounds like one is for sure immune. The second one is probably immune. But that's 60% of the case. So I think he goes forward. But I do think that Judge Chutkan has to rule. I think there will be an appeal. It will go back to the Supreme Court, as you said, before we get clarity. But I think there is a good bit of this case that is still alive, and we should go forward. And if I may, just want to say one more thing about the underlings. So the president is immune, right? But I don't think the underlings are. So Jeffrey Clark, who is under indictment in Georgia, may still face criminal charges there. But here's the game plan. Who called it the roadmap or the blueprint for going forward? When the president assassinates his rivals, he doesn't do it himself, of course. He has underlings do it. He pardons the underlings.
Yeah.
So that's how they get away with this abuse of power.
I mean, it's just an utterly disturbing path forward. Jill, how did you take what was left for Jack Smith?
I agree with Barb. There is definitely enough to go forward with. And the delay that would be involved and the likely outcome with the Supreme Court of challenging the definition of what falls within, even though I think it's clearly not within the presumptive immunity category, I think that you just have to go ahead with the ones that are clearly personal and political and acts of candidate Trump, not President Trump, even though they happened while he was president. There has to be recognition that some conduct as president, I mean, you know that certain phone calls can't be made from his office because they are political. And so I think that Jack Smith proceeds with the counts that are clearly political and personal and not in any way, shape, or form subject to presidential authority. And I agree with Barb that it is concerning that the people who carry out these orders can be held accountable and have been held accountable and will continue to be held accountable, and that if he is still in office, he can pardon them. Now, he can pardon them while he is president, as long as he's doing these acts while he's president. I have always questioned whether the preemptive pardon that was issued by Gerald Ford was a legal thing to say, any future conduct I'm pardoning you for, or any conduct that you haven't been indicted for. These weren't pardons for things that he's been tried or convicted or shown any remorse. And normally pardons are reserved for people who show some remorse, have served their full sentence, but it happened and it was allowed to happen and probably would be again. Certainly this Supreme Court would allow it to happen as long as the person issuing the pardon was Donald Trump or some other MAGA person. If Joe Biden tried doing any of these things, including getting rid of an existential threat to democracy, like possibly Donald Trump, I'm sure the court would find that it was in that category of totally personal and that they would not give him immunity for that. So that's what I think.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate just briefly here and say that if I was Jack Smith, I would actually go forward with as much of my indictment as I could credibly believe I would be able to obtain a conviction and sustain it on. And I might really push for inclusion of some of this conduct in that second category and then make the argument the Supreme Court says you have to make to bust out of that category, which is essentially that prosecuting wouldn't impact the power of the presidency. And, you know, I would do that because I think it's a colorable argument. For instance, that maybe the conversations with the leadership at DOJ were okay in official function, but when you got the head of Environment and Natural Resources Division on the phone and a congressman is introducing him to you and you're talking about that stuff, I think I'd be willing to make that argument if only to get the Supreme Court to force them to go on record a second time. as saying it, or to see if you might get a more favorable reading, because this is a bad decision. This is a Supreme Court decision that will live in infamy. It will be reversed one day. The only question is how soon and how much damage gets done first. And speaking of damage, Jill, sentencing has been delayed in the Manhattan DA's case. There are a lot of people who believe that that case is now in question, not because of the charges, but because of the use of evidence. Part of the Supreme Court's decision in Trump versus United States was you can't use evidence of official acts to convict someone. And so now that's the argument that Trump is making in Manhattan. What's going on there, and what do you make of all that?
So just to give some background, there is a concept of harmless error, and that's what he's going to have to argue, is that, yes, some official acts were put into evidence, but he would have been convicted even without that evidence, and so it didn't affect the outcome. Otherwise, there's going to have to be a retrial without that evidence, and that would be terrible. The sentencing delay is to allow some analysis of what the evidence was, whether any of it was within this very broad category of presidential conduct that the Supreme Court has laid out, and if it has, whether it was something that affected the outcome or whether it was harmless error. So it's, again, it's a mess that we're seeing right away what has happened from this broad decision.
Yeah, I mean, I'm worried about the harmless error argument because some of this evidence, like the Hope Hicks conversations, in closing, the prosecution was like, this is our linchpin piece of evidence. And it's hard to say it wasn't harmless error. I know they've got like a procedural default argument. You have to raise immunity at a certain stage in the case. And if you don't, you can't make it later on. And that argument's floating around. But I got to say, I am worried about that case. And Barb, that leaves us with the other cases, right? They're still pending, the federal case in Florida and Georgia. How does this decision impact them?
Well, Florida, I think, is actually in pretty good shape because Florida mostly relates to post-White House activity. He's charged there with unlawfully retaining sensitive documents and obstructing an investigation. Now, I suppose it's possible that they had planned to use some evidence from while Donald Trump was in office. And that could get tricky. You know, remember he was those examples where he was very reckless with the use of classified documents and things. But I think they can very much try the case without using any of that evidence. So I think that case is on firm ground. The Georgia case, however, I think is on very equal footing with the federal election interference case because it alleges much of the same conduct. And so I think they're going to have to go through the same kind of litigation there to say what's official and what's unofficial. Maybe they look to what happens in the federal case, but they're going to have to make the same determination. So I don't know if you just stay it and let the feds sort it all out, or if you address it separately and they go up to the court together. But I think it's going to be, you know, the Georgia case, of course, is more comprehensive than the federal case. I think in an effort to really streamline it, Jack Smith charged only Donald Trump. The Georgia case brings in, you know, 19 defendants in a RICO case, but many of the same acts. It's all based on the same conduct. So I think we're going to have to go through the same exercise in Georgia, which means delay of well over a year or more before this case ever goes to trial.
Well, this has been such an upbeat first topic, y'all.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect for breakfast. Like buy a sausage burrito and add a sausage McMuffin for a dollar. Get more than you expect with new McValue at McDonald's.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
The court decided another pair of significant cases on Monday. You may have missed it in light of all of the hullabaloo. But these cases were called NetChoice versus Paxton and Moody versus NetChoice. So in both of these cases, industry groups for tech companies had challenged statutes that were enacted in Texas and Florida, making it illegal for social media platforms to moderate content in compliance with their own community standards, or to take down someone's account altogether, to deplatform them, like Donald Trump. In both cases, the plaintiffs argued that platforms like Facebook and YouTube had removed some content following the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol in a way that was discriminating against conservative viewpoints. Joyce, the court decided 9-0 that these cases needed to go back to lower courts without addressing the merits. Kind of anticlimactic after that long wait. Why was that their decision?
Yeah, it was anticlimactic. I mean, the judgments get vacated and the cases get remanded for further proceedings because, according to the Supreme Court, neither the 11th nor the 5th Circuit applied the proper standard for a facial First Amendment challenge. Here's what that means. There are two types of key constitutional challenges. A facial challenge is a challenge to the face of the statute as written that says this statute is unconstitutional as written. And then there are as applied challenges. Once a law goes into effect, sometimes there will be a challenge that says, as this law is applied to me, it's unconstitutional. Well, these cases were a facial challenge, saying that this law, for all purposes, for all time, both Texas and Florida, they're unconstitutional as written. They impact my free speech in an unconstitutional way. And a facial challenge is a lot more difficult to make out than an as-applied challenge. A plaintiff essentially has to show that there's no set of circumstances under which the law would be valid. And so here's what the majority says. They say, and we heard some of this at oral argument, to be frank. This wasn't out of the blue. But the court says, you know, all that they really looked at were sort of like feeds on social media, and there's so much else. There's direct messaging. Justice Kagan writes, the technology is changing all the time. There are new apps and new things. And so they tell the courts of appeals, go back and do it again, and then tell us what you think. So that's where we ended up.
Yeah, Kim, one interesting thing about this case, though, is even though the court did not decide the case on the merits, Justice Kagan went ahead and wrote a lengthy opinion anyway for the majority, saying, but you know, if we did decide this, here's what's on my mind. And, you know, she got a majority of the justices to agree. And she kind of lays out the legal standard based on her opinion. Do you think these challenges are likely to succeed in the long run?
So too long didn't read for Justice Kagan's opinion is basically like, this is not how you do a facial challenge. But if you did do an as-applied challenge, you're going to lose. And let me tell you why. Basically, what she is saying is you have to show that Texas would have to show that there is a substantial state interest at stake that they're advancing, even in an as-applied challenge. And what she writes is Texas has never been shy and always been consistent about its interests. The objective is to correct the mix of viewpoints that major platforms present. But a state may not interfere with private actors' speech to advance its own vision of ideological balance. So it's like y'all got nothing out the gate. So you may want to save some of your taxpayers' time, you know. Texans are very hardworking. Maybe you just let this go, but you know they won't. But she's just saying, yeah, you're not going to win.
Yeah, really interesting. And so, Jill, there are other justices who kind of took her to task and took the majority to task, right? And saying, you can't do that. It's a mistake to address the merits at all. If the court's not deciding the merits, then it's a mistake to actually issue this sort of advisory opinion. Do you agree with those concurring justices?
I do. And it takes me back to law school where, I mean, I haven't thought about dicta in a long time, except the TV show that's called Dicta.
I used to have a blog. That's how long it was. A blog called DC Dicta back in the day.
Okay, so there
and
you
I
go.
Found out right. that Ruth Bader Ginsburg read it, but I'll talk about that later.
Whoa, I want to hear about that.
Another time.
But to answer Barb's question, yeah, I mean, advisory opinions. You know, we've talked about it on several episodes where we've talked about how you have to have parties that have something at stake. You can't have people that don't have standing. You don't issue advisory opinions. You decide cases or controversies. And so saying that this is not relevant to the decision is like saying, yeah, you shouldn't be saying it. It was interesting and might give some pause to whether they're going to refile as a, you know, keep it at a facial level or an as applied level. Although I think that, you know, even Barrett in her concurring opinion sort of says, you know, the Florida court just wasn't right about the First Amendment. And so, you know, she's kind of signaling again, they're going to lose. So why bother? But they will, because it's a political issue. And so they're going to stay on it.
Yeah. You know, I have to say that if you look at the merits of what Justice Kagan writes, I think she's right, right? I mean, states can't tell private actors, you must print everything that everybody puts out there. But I think this case really does demonstrate just how difficult it is going to be going forward to regulate social media in a meaningful way, to address disinformation, especially as artificial intelligence grows in its prevalence. So this one will be back, I'm sure. So we'll keep an eye on this one.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
There's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But the clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
We are living in a post-Chevron world, but I am not a post-Chevron girl. You know that we are living. That's right. Chevron is gone. Chevron is gone, y'all. And already we are seeing the impacts of it. You know, sometimes it's hard to explain complex legal doctrines and their effect on actual people, but courts are already giving us a real life taste of what our new post-Chevron world looks like. We talked about the Supreme Court's decision overturning Chevron last week. It essentially held that experts in federal agencies who were tasked with implementing rules and regulations affecting nearly every aspect of our American lives can be overruled by federal judges with no such expertise if the federal law is found to be ambiguous. And of course, federal law is always ambiguous, right? Sometimes by design. But now we have two fresh rulings giving us a glimpse at what our future is. Jill, tell us about the ruling out of Gulfport, Mississippi that brought to a halt a federal rule meant to protect transgender health care. And how did the end of Chevron play into that?
Well, you know, when we talked about the Chevron decision last episode, we talked about what we thought might happen in terms of the courts making these decisions instead of experts making the decisions about the demise of administrative agencies' power to do what their expertise really should empower them to do. And here's another example where the president has his cabinet and tells one department or tells all departments, you should look at making sure that when the word sex appears and barred is the discrimination on the basis of sex is barred, that that also includes gender identity. And so there was a ruling that when there was any kind of insurance that the federal government paid for, Medicare, Medicaid, that when it said you can't discriminate on the basis of sex, sex includes gender identity. And the court said, no, we're not going to go along with that. And that agency doesn't have the power to make that regulation to include gender identity. And so I'm sure this will be appealed. I have no doubt that the Biden administration will pursue this, that right now healthcare can be denied on the basis of your gender identity. And that really is something that all of the supporters of this regulation are going, we have the same rights to our healthcare as anyone else. And I agree.
So, Barb, a few episodes back, we talked about the FTC ruling, the Federal Trade Commission ruling, that barred non-compete agreements for workers. And that is a big deal. But another federal court, this time in Texas, had other ideas about that. It's sort of in the same vein as what we're talking about. We get these agency rules and we get these judges slapping them down. What happened there?
Yeah, so a judge granted a temporary restraining order to block this rule from taking effect. It's only a temporary rule, but the judge said, I think there is a likelihood of success on the merits that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, lacks the authority, the rulemaking authority regarding unfair methods of competition. And courts are better situated to do that. So we'll hear all of this. And ultimately, I'm confident that the plaintiffs will prevail. This was a tax preparation company in Texas that filed a lawsuit saying that the FTC lacks the rulemaking power to do this. And, you know, after this overruling of Chevron, what the FTC says is no longer going to get any deference. But, what the FTC said, we, based on our findings that non-compete agreements reduce innovation, they inhibit economic growth, and they keep wages low. It prevents people from, leaving one company and working at another. In rural communities, this is especially problematic with hospitals where doctors can't move from one place to another because there's a geographic ban on their ability to go work for some other hospital. So it's a very pro-business thing that wants to kind of keep its employees close and not allow them to go away, work for some higher bidder. But after Chevron, I think this judge is probably right in terms of, no need to defer to the FTC. Judges have appointed themselves, in the words of dissenting Justice Elena Kagan, the nation's administrative czar. And so courts will decide for themselves whether these non-competes can survive.
Wow, that data that you were talking about, Barb, that sounds like expertise in the area. And, but judges, of course, they know better. And I hadn't even thought about that. That actually is, you think about that, you live someplace where, that's not Boston, that's not LA, that doesn't have all, this isn't teeming with doctors. You live in a place that has good health care, but it's given by a certain number of people and they can't work and they can't provide health care to the people who need it because of non-competes. I mean, that's crazy, right? Anyway, I'll stop. Joyce, be our voice of reason here. These decisions will likely be appealed. What does that look like after Chevron? We talk about doom and gloom. And it's not that these agencies can't be heard at all, but the standard is surely different. What do you think it means as these agencies fight to say, no, these rules that we are implementing are important. This is our job. Let us do it.
I'm sorry, but if you're looking for the voice of reason after watching the Supreme Court this term, it ain't going to be me, girl. I am looking forward to flying on airplanes where engines are attached by two bolts instead of 12 because the Supreme Court thinks they know better than experts. In the post-Chevron world, all that really matters is what the Supreme Court thinks, right? And if they think that an agency, that a law passed by Congress is ambiguous, then they believe it's up to the imperial courts to decide what the rule is going to be. They don't have to take into account any agency expertise. And given the texture of the court's recent decisions, I think we all know that the culture wars are just as likely to be fought in the Supreme Court as they are in the halls of Congress. We live in a very troubling time. The only way to right-size what's going on in the judiciary is to to vote for a president who will make sure that judges who are appointed are more moderate in their views, not politically, but moderate in their views about their own power and their accumulation of power. Undoing the administrative state has been a long-term conservative goal. They now have all the tools that they need in place to do it, and I think we would be foolish to not anticipate that they will. So we can look forward to decisions like this going up on appeal, and for the most part, getting a nod of support from the appellate courts.
Oof. And here's, I'll just leave us all with one last thought on this, which is, this is why it's so concerning to me that the mifepristone decision, right, was done on a procedural basis, which means it'll come back. Somebody else, they'll get somebody else, maybe somebody who took mifepristone, who will pass the standard of standing to come back. The EMTALA case is coming back. There will be, we have even more cases on transgender healthcare. We'll have even more cases on immigration and other things that we need to fix our economy, to keep our access to healthcare, to do all sorts of, to keep the planes in the air. Gosh, now you terrified me, Joyce.
Sorry.
But they're going to be coming. And do you want judges making those decisions?
Not when
experts?
They can't tell the difference between nitrous oxide and nitrogen listen, oxide.
Listen,
that's just the laughing gas talking.
Yeah, and that was from the son of the woman who headed the EPA and fought for Chevron after he helped to delete Chevron.
Mm-mm-mm. Bless Neil Gorsuch's heart.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
There's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But the clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world you stay you wherever you go. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Well, that was a great episode, but now we're going to go to our favorite part of the show, which is listener questions. And I want you to remember that if you have a question for us, you can email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us at sistersinlaw.podcast on Threads or tweet using hashtag sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your questions during the show, keep an eye on our thread or tweet feeds throughout the week where we'll answer as many of your questions as we can. This week, let me go straight to a question from Terry for Joyce. Can President Biden transfer the title of Chief Justice from John Roberts to another justice? If so, would that action need to be confirmed by the Senate?
This is a great question, Terry, and unfortunately, the answer is no. No, he cannot. Just like associate justices are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate before they take office, the chief justice is in a special category, and you're actually nominated to be the chief justice, and your confirmation in the Senate is as the chief justice. You don't have to have been an associate justice before you can be the chief, although in many cases that's true. The reality is that we are stuck with Chief Justice John Roberts until he resigns or leaves office in some other fashion. He's it.
Kim, I want to ask you a question that comes in from Ellen. How do Supreme Court concurrences work? If the court reaches a decision through slightly different paths or arguments, is only the majority opinion held as precedent, or can concurrent opinions be used as well?
So, yes and. So the way that concurrences work generally, if you have we know the way it normally works. If you have five or more justices on one side, but you have someone who believes that the court could have gotten to that outcome in a different way or using different legal reasoning, then that is what a concurrence is. But for the record, when it comes to who wins and who loses that case, that concurrence still counts with the majority when we say, you know, it's 6-3, 7-2 or whatever. But for precedential reasons, which is what you're talking about. It's just who was in the majority with that reasoning. So if it was five in the majority and one concurrence, that's five people. Now, this is important because there are decisions that have plurality holdings, which means less than five people made the opinion. And in that case, that still allows a win if it's, you know, maybe you have a plurality of four people who find under one reasoning, three people who also find for one side, but under a different reasoning, and then everyone else dissents. The only thing that that means is that the party in that case wins. Without five justices, there's no binding precedent. So that means that the courts below don't have to follow it. They can use it as guidance as to what the high court might do. But unless five justices bless a certain kind of reasoning, it's not precedent. It takes five to make a precedent. So it's a great question.
Great answer, Kim. And Barb, here's a question from Jody. What happens if either Trump or President Biden dies before their nomination at the convention, or after the nomination but before the inauguration?
Well, great question, Jody. I had to look this up, but there is an answer to your question. So the 20th Amendment addresses this to some extent. Section 3 of the 20th Amendment says, if at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president-elect shall have died, the vice president-elect shall become president. So that's only after the person becomes the president-elect. But of course, a person does not become a president-elect until after the Electoral College casts its votes in December. And so if a candidate for president dies before that, and say the timing matters, say it's before the convention or before the election in November or before those electoral votes are cast in December, then the parties choose. So at this moment, we have two candidates who are referred to as the presumptive nominees, but they're really not until the convention. And so if one were to die even before the convention, then those delegates get released. They are no longer bound to that candidate, and the delegates would vote to see who is going to be the candidate. And if it's after the convention or after the election, then it's the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee who chooses. And none of them are required to choose the vice president to fill the shoes of the president until after the electoral votes are cast in December.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters in Law with Kimberly Atkins-Store, Joyce Vance, Barb McQuaid, and me, Jill Wine Banks. And please show some love to this week's sponsors, Factor, Aura, Osea Malibu, Olive & June, and Helix. Their links are in the show notes. Please support them because they make this podcast possible. Follow Hashtag Sisters in Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to a podcast. And please give us a 5-star review to help others find the show. See you next week with another episode, Hashtag Sisters in Law.
You know, well, there's a famous 11th Circuit opinion about Blackie the talking cat. I'm sure I've told this story before.
No.
Yeah, Blackie's owner gets sued for vagrancy. And the owner, one of the things he pleads is Blackie's First Amendment rights. The court finds against the owner. And the 11th Circuit says, as for Blackie, he can speak for himself.
That's great.
It's a great opinion.
That is fantastic.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.